Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence is trying to reduce domestic violence through prevention messaging. Will it work? But up front, if you travel to a European country in the near future, you'll have to prove that you've been vaccinated against COVID-19. Airlines and cruise ships may do the same. Several professional sports teams want proof of testing or a vaccination before allowing fans into their stadiums or arenas. Will that card that those that have been vaccinated receive, showing that the holder has gotten his or her shots, act as a vaccine passport and be required before being admitted to some place's business or events? Or will there be a digital passport you carry on your phone? And it also has raised some privacy issues for some. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Michael Sievers, Assistant Professor of Healthcare Informatics, and Dr. Eric Hefty, who is Assistant Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences, both at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Dr. Sievers, let me start with you. A vaccine passport. How would you envision a vaccine passport?
Well, with a vaccine passport, some people call it a vaccine passport. Some now are calling it vaccine certificate or certification. The idea is that someone can show that they have proof of being vaccinated for COVID-19 and then is able to move freely through our society, much like we did pre-COVID. The interesting thing is some countries not only are looking at the vaccine, but also proof that maybe you had COVID as a possibility as well.
So what do you think that vaccine passport would look like?
Well, at first, we have the CDC card right now, which is just a paper card that you get a sticker on for your first inoculation. If you have Moderna or Pfizer, you get a second one with a sticker. However, there's a lot of companies now that are doing an electronic option. The various situations out there are the digital green certificate that the EU is doing, Travel Pass and Common Pass. So there are different software companies out there that are trying to get into the market of this that has your information and you can show it on, let's say, an iPhone or anything like that to, as you were saying, like a concert or a sporting event to get into that particular venue.
Dr. Eric Hefty, I'm just curious about your thoughts on this. Europe has adopted a type of passport. Do you think that the U.S. will follow?
I don't think in the same way as Europe is currently implementing it for a number of reasons. We already have different states adopting different postures on this so-called vaccine passport. Some are adopting it right now, like New York has the Excelsior Pass, which is an app that they're currently rolling out, whereas others like Texas and Florida you have state mandates that quote unquote ban any kind of state use of a vaccine passport or any vaccine mandates. So you're never going to have a harmonized system like you may be able to achieve in other places like Israel or Europe potentially, just because we approach this from different perspectives based on the states we reside in. So I don't think it's going to take the same form. However, you may see private enterprises, private industries try to develop a little bit more harmonized system, but I don't envision that going too far in terms of a universally accepted system of proving vaccination status.
Why don't you think you see it going that far? Because of that inconsistency or the fact that right now what's driving this in the U.S. is maybe corporations, private entities rather than the government?
Right. And the federal government is so far has not supported a universal vaccine passport per se. They may offer guidances on such a tool, but they're not going that far either. So I just don't think it's realistic to expect that all of our states are going to agree on a single way of actually proving vaccine status, just because it has turned into somewhat of a controversial issue with regards to privacy, with regards to control of private health information, and even a logistical point of view. How do we roll this out? Not everybody has a connected device. As Dr. Seaver said, we have these cards, but they're not a federally or state issued ID. They're not secure at all. So the number of moving parts here, I don't think is conducive to having some kind of uniform system anytime soon.
If you'd like to weigh in on this,
Scott, can I interject?
Go ahead, Dr. Seavers. Yeah.
As well, because we have some folks in the United States that actually can't get the vaccine because of medical reasons. And we also have a population that, because of religious reasons, they don't want to get the vaccine. So it's going to be a little bit tough from an equities perspective for this. And the other challenge that we're going to have is we don't know how long these vaccines actually last. So if you're getting a vaccine passport, how long into the future does that really last until you need some type of booster shot or something like that? Thanks.
So many issues that, and I do want to discuss some of those issues, but I want to let our audience know that if you have a question or a comment, want to weigh in on this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And, you know, the point that you just brought up, Dr. Seavers, I think is a good one, and is different here in the U.S. than some other countries as well. Not only those that can opt out for religious reasons, but as we have seen so far with vaccinations, that there have been some inequities of where people can get vaccinations. We know that there are minority groups that haven't gotten their vaccinations as quickly as, you know, maybe in those middle class neighborhoods or middle class counties. So there seems to be a big difference there, and that would seem to keep this from actually happening, because the United States has not been as quick to vaccinate people. Would you agree?
I would agree. And we have situations like is happening in Michigan right now with the numbers going up. Michigan has been begging for more vaccinations, but the administration isn't giving it so that you have equal distribution across the United States. So if we have hotspots in the United States, the question is, from a policy perspective, should we be targeting more vaccines in that particular area like Michigan or not? But to your point also, Scott, regarding like rural folks or minorities, Hispanics, African Americans, et cetera, the percentage for vaccinations is not as high as, let's say, the white population. Even we're seeing that in Pennsylvania. And the other issue that we also have, and Dr. Hefty was bringing it up, is the digital divide, because these areas not only might not have options for the vaccines, but they don't have the internet connections as well to even get scheduled for the vaccines. Or if we get into this vaccine passport, to actually have iPhones to show that they have the vaccine. So it's definitely a challenge from an inequity perspective.
Let's take a phone call from John in Lebanon County. John, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My understanding is that vaccination does not necessarily prevent people from being contagious. So, since all of the efforts have been to prevent the contagion from spreading, how is it then that these certificates would enable people to move around easily when they can still contaminate other people?
Dr. Hefty, I'm going to put that one to you and just add to what John asked, in that that so much of COVID-19 is unknown. I mean, we've only known about this virus for a year, but the point that he makes, that there are some reports that it still is contagious. others that we don't know. So the point that he raises, is it a good one?
Yeah, caller raises a great point. First off, like you mentioned, we're still learning a lot about this virus. It seems like it's been forever, but it's really only been about a year since this came on our radar. So there are some reports that do suggest that the individuals that are vaccinated are less likely to spread it to others. However, much of the reports are not peer reviewed. It's still very preliminary. So that leads to a larger point of letting our guard down, which I think is one of the biggest dangers of this so-called vaccine passport. I think there's a lot of good intentions here, but one potential effect of this that I think flies under the radar often is if you have this vaccine passport, just like the caller said, there are going to be some people that are going to be emboldened to drop their guard. And just like Dr. Siever was saying in Michigan, we're seeing a resurgence of infections. So I'm concerned that if you have a large group of people that have this so-called passport, that may lead them to be more lax with mask wearing, social distancing, hygiene when it comes to respiratory hygiene. And that could lead down a difficult road, since the vaccines, while highly effective and everybody should get vaccinated, they're not 100%. Even 90%, 95%, there's still 5% chance you could get that infection. So currently, the infection rate is just so high that there's a risk here of having this false sense of security. I'm vaccinated. I no longer need to socially distance, wear a mask, et cetera. So I think that's another potential effect that the caller was kind of leading into as well.
And something related, the variants. I mean, this we not only are learning so much about this virus as we go, but as we move along, there have been different forms of the virus that are now in the U.S. and around the world. And again, not sure how the vaccines, so far, so good with most of them. But who's to say there's not going to be another variant that the vaccines are not effective with, Dr. Hefty?
Yeah, and again, this whole disease is really a constantly moving target. So when we're trying to pinpoint somebody's status, you know, like as Dr. Sievers was saying, we're still not sure how long this vaccine lasts. How do you update this? You have different variants. The B.1.1.7 variant, it seems to be, the vaccine seems to be relatively effective against these variants so far, which is great. However, that could change in 2 weeks. We're moving as fast as science allows us, which is often quite slow. So that's good. We're moving pretty quickly in understanding this, but I fear that you're going to have a constantly moving target that you're trying to pin down, and it's going to lull people into a false sense of security when in reality it's much more complicated than just getting a single shot or two shots and, you know, washing your hands of this, so to speak, and being done, move on with your life. We still have a long way to go, unfortunately, but luckily things are, I think, moving in a relatively positive direction, but I don't think now is the time to let our guard down.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing so-called vaccine passports. I don't know if I'd say a requirement. The government's not requiring it. Some private corporations, private entities, European countries are now, that some proof that a person has been vaccinated against COVID-19. And as you've listened to our conversation, there seem to be some holes in how valuable this would be here in the U.S., and maybe Europe will find the same thing. Our guest, Dr. Michael Sievers, Assistant Professor of Healthcare Informatics, and Dr. Eric Hefty, Assistant Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences, both at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. If you have a question or a comment, how do you feel about the vaccine passport? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And we have a question here from a listener who says, some people are getting a sticker for each shot. I don't recall ever getting a sticker on my car. My card information is written in. How are shots supposed to be recognized by a sticker? Now, that's, I think the stickers are just kind of a nice little thing to show people that you've been vaccinated, kind of like the I voted sticker that you get. But, you know, he does bring up points that the listener brings up a point that shows that there are similar situations across the country with different things. I mean, some people have pointed out that when a child goes to school, they have to show that they've been vaccinated against certain illnesses and diseases. So what's the big difference here, Dr. Severs?
Actually, a very good question. First of all, there's no standardization across the board at this point in time. As you were alluding to, there's a lot of paper that's out there. And unfortunately, and I'm going to hit the healthcare U.S. system in general, we seem to love paper, even fax machines and things like that. And getting to electronics is very, very tough. And it's going to be a challenge to get a standardization, especially if the federal government doesn't get in the mix along the way. I'm not a major person that loves government regulations, but healthcare seems to be the area that needs a push. We needed a push with HIPAA and electronic data interchange transactions so that health insurance companies and doctors could talk to each other. Then we needed high tech so that we had electronic health record systems in the hospitals. And then we needed a push from ACA, which was Obamacare, to get health information exchanges so hospitals could talk to each other. Now we're to the point that we need another push to standardize different things. Your listeners might not be aware, but April 5th, the federal government put in place these new blocking rules. And basically it's saying that a doctor, provider, hospital cannot refuse access to patients to provide health information to them at all and at no charge. So with vaccine situations like passports, et cetera, it will open up the electronic information as well. But I do want to point out one thing, and I think it's interesting. You brought up schools. Obviously, colleges are saying that do you need some type of proof for a vaccination as we go into fall semester of this year? And some universities that are on the hook right now are like Rutgers, Cornell, Northeastern. But Virginia Tech, even though they're going to require it, they're bringing up a point that's very valid and people forget about. These vaccines are on emergency approval. They actually haven't been absolutely approved. It's on emergency approval. So we're in a little bit of an odd situation from a legal perspective. Emergency approvals haven't been settled in the courts when it comes to FDA and CDC and things like that. So it's going to be interesting to see what the colleges and universities do come the fall of this year.
Point you just brought up, though, you said that it would seem that there would have to be some kind of government intervention for this to be consistent across the board. And that's what concerns many people, especially from a privacy standpoint. You know, in fact, you know, and this is probably just an example of our cultural wars in this country, but this is the biggest objection you hear from many people is a privacy standpoint that, I don't want anyone to have access to my medical records or, you know that I've had COVID or know that I've had a vaccine. You know, this is private information. Dr. Severs, what about that, that privacy argument?
Well, it's absolutely true, and it interferes with HIPAA at the same time on what can be given out. So from a security perspective, with these new software apps coming online, the question is how secure will they be? How secure really is your iPhone if somebody's walking past you and could maybe get your information? And what are these companies going to do with it? Because some of these are startup companies. So it's going to be a real question on the give and take of the vaccine passport versus your secure. And obviously, we're going into some unknown territory with this. So you bring up a good question. I don't have answers for that particular question going forward, at least not yet.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Nathan.
And you're right about government
Go ahead.
Well, and you're right about government regulations. People don't like government regulations, but I still promote the fact that healthcare, unfortunately, has needed the push from government. Banking industry, even some of the railroad industry, pick, pack, and ship, they haven't needed as much of a push because they've actually done their own things with initiative and new software, et cetera. But healthcare seems to be on the back burner. For your listening audience, think how many times you've gone into maybe a dentist's office and still see paper manila folders along the way. So healthcare needs push when it comes to advancements. Thank you.
I think those folders are part of the furniture. But you mentioned a fax machine. It surprises me today how much, how often you can hear or hear a story from someone who's been to a doctor's office, a dentist office, and say, well, fax your records over. I can't remember the last time I faxed anything. I don't know if I still know how to use the fax machine. So, you know, it shows that in some ways we are behind. Let's take a phone call from Nathan in Mechanicsburg.
Hi, y'all. I'm a nurse. I've worked in a travel clinic in the past. So I was thinking perhaps over time what we might see as far as the passports is in international travel. There are countries, for instance, that require yellow fever vaccine upon entry. So I'm wondering if over time, you know, if the COVID-19 is endemic or continues to be pandemic in some countries, if you know, there might be a requirement depending on if incidences are low and you're going in, or if incidences are high and you want to protect yourself. And the other comment I had as far as paper and the technology divide is potentially, I participated in the clinic and I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice if there was a QR code on the back of these vaccine cards so that it could just be scanned for travel, et cetera. Mm.
Hey, Nathan, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Hefty, again, you know, we've made similar comparisons, but the point that Nathan raises, you know, Europe, Israel, for example, Israel, not in Europe, obviously, but Israel is a country that is requiring a so-called passport. They don't call it a vaccine passport. To roam freely throughout the country, do different things. The point that Nathan makes, different countries requiring proof of vaccination for yellow fever, for example. What is the difference here?
Yeah, proof of vaccination for international travel is nothing really that new. It's been implemented before. The current issue here is, it's a bit more complicated because something like yellow fever, that's a single vaccine. It's 100% effective. It's for life. Now we have a bunch of different vaccines from Russia, China, the United States, Great Britain, et cetera, et cetera. What vaccines are going to be recognized in different countries for you to be able to be qualified as vaccinated? That's one of the big current problems with international travel and the use of these. The caller has a fantastic point about the yellow fever vaccine, but the problem here is we have this menagerie of different vaccinations, and not all of them are approved in all of these countries, and even in the United States, as Dr. Seaver said, we have an emergency use authorization for these vaccines, which is necessary given the circumstances, but these vaccines aren't even fully approved yet. So how do we navigate that with international travel? I don't have an answer, All I have are potential problems, unfortunately. At the current stage, I think as time goes on and hopefully more people get vaccinated and the infection rate goes down, there can be some room for more harmonization and more recognition of these different vaccines. However, at the current state, it's going to be difficult to implement given the differences in efficacies and new strains coming out in international travel.
Let's take another call from...
And Scott, can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Severs.
Can I interject real quick? And the colleges and universities, as Dr. Hefty was pointing out, are struggling with this because for international students coming to the United States, I mean, if you're in Russia, you're getting the Sputnik V. If you're China, you're getting something different. So these aren't approved here in the United States. So colleges and universities are really wrestling with the fact that, yes, there's going to need to be a vaccine passport, but what are they going to okay as they're bringing these students in, especially a fall of next year? So that's another issue that we're going to have to wrestle with.
Well, related to that, we have an email from Stacy who says, I'm a graduate student within the Pennsylvania system of state schools. They've made the announcement that they are not requiring vaccinations for students to return to school. We will be resuming in-person classes next month, and several of my fellow students do not plan to get the vaccination. And she says that I'm uncomfortable with this. You know, that's another side to the story is that, you know, you have people who have decided they're not going to get vaccinated. They will be mixed in with people who have been vaccinated. You know, how this relates directly to a passport, I don't know. But the point that Stacy's bringing up, Dr. Severs, is something that you just addressed, that not just international students, but even American-born students have that concern.
Absolutely. And the other thing that people are forgetting is there is a certain percentage of the population that actually, for medical reasons, can't get this particular vaccine or COVID vaccines. And that's a challenge as well. What do these institutions do for those particular people? Now, some universities are going with like a hybrid approach that they're obviously promoting, going back to on-ground classes. But for those students that are apprehensive or have medical reasons or religious reasons, they could still do Zoom or Skype or whatever you want to call it from a virtual perspective. So they are colleges and universities are trying to deal with that issue and utilize virtual continuing on.
Let's go to Willie in York. Willie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. This is an excellent topic. I just want to go, I own a business myself, and I've been here for quite a while. I've been in the business for 27 years. I've never seen anything like this. But I talk to the customers and people all the time, and I agree with them. There needs to be a lot of public debate about this, and we're not seeing that, and we're not hearing it. Like the other lady said, I'm very, very extremely untrustworthy of all of the things involved here, especially politicians, scientists, because things aren't open. There's no trust in there. And I really think it's an overblown and overreach policy to try to vaccinate everyone. But what I'm hearing is not truly a vaccination shot by the true definition of a vaccination. And we just don't want it. I mean, there's no change in the behavior when you get the shot, and that's a concern. I mean, the overall disgust and disagreement. I mean, the immune system. I never hear anyone talk about the immune system. We have natural, born, God-given immune system to take care of anything. We don't want, we don't need shots.
So, Willie, thank you very much for your call. But, Dr. Hefty, I think that what Willie's opinion points out is that not everyone is on board with getting a shot. And that is just what you had talked about earlier, or both of you have talked about earlier, that whether you have a passport or not, there are going to be some people who will be left out from being able to go to Europe or do different things if a passport is required.
Right, and I think that goes to the inequities that may stem from this. However, what I will say is that as more people get vaccinated, and I just want to reiterate, vaccines are incredibly effective at reducing hospitalizations, fatalities, et cetera. I strongly recommend that everybody gets a vaccine as long as you're medically qualified to do so. They do save lives. That being said, those that are vaccine hesitant or vaccine resistant, hopefully as more and more people do get the vaccine, we will arrive at a place where infection levels will decrease to the point where the inequities will subside, because we will have less of a need for these kind of lasting quote unquote proofs. If we even do need them, that's an open debate, and it should be debated, as the caller said. It should be have a robust debate. But I think hopefully, and trying to stay optimistic, I think as we move into the future, we're going to see less infections, hopefully more control over these variants, and those inequities that may arise from such a system of vaccine passports will become a thing of the past.
Well, we shall see. I mean, this is an issue that obviously there will be some more discussion. When the caller talked about politicians, I think that sometimes that's where people lose some trust, because they wonder whether a politician has an agenda about this. But so far, much of the discussion about vaccine passports has been in the political arena. Dr. Michael Sievers, Assistant Professor of Healthcare Informatics, Dr. Eric Hefty, Assistant Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences, both at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. There are reports from across the country and indeed around the world that incidents of domestic violence have increased during the coronavirus pandemic. During the last year, more couples and families have been at home together. Many have lost jobs or income, or have turned to alcohol or drugs. The Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence is on a campaign to prevent domestic violence rather than just make the public aware of it. Joining us now is Director of Prevention for the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Kristen Herman. Ms. Herman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, you know, I said that there have been more incidents of domestic violence across the country and around the world. I've seen different statistics. What do you know of? Do we know of what's happened in Pennsylvania? Has there been more domestic violence?
You know, I can't say for sure. I don't have statistics specific to Pennsylvania. I know our local programs, we have 60 local programs that cover all 67 counties of Pennsylvania, have seen an increase in hotline calls to their domestic violence hotlines. And that's similar to what we're seeing across the country. Other states are having anywhere from a 10 to a 30% increase in hotline and police calls regarding domestic violence.
And you kind of anticipated what I was going to ask then. I mean, there's a difference between reports, confirming that a domestic violence, that an incident has occurred. And let's face it, that during this pandemic, it has been difficult to measure through statistics because things are so different. But, you know, I provided a couple reasons in the introduction why there would be more domestic violence. What do you attribute it to, if there is?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, one of what domestic violence is, I guess let's start there, is a pattern of one person using different tactics to have power and control over another person. And one of the most successful tactics, unfortunately, is isolation, taking folks away from resources, from their community, from being able to access local domestic violence programs that can help. And when we're in a national pandemic where the resources are focused on other things, where folks are not able to leave their houses, it becomes that much more challenging for them to access touch points where they might be able to get help.
You've decided, when I say you, meaning the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence, to try to reduce or stop domestic violence a different way. Prevention rather than awareness. Talk about that. In what ways are you pushing prevention, or when I say pushing, I don't mean to downplay it, that you are focusing on prevention rather than just making people aware?
Right. Well, I think we're trying to broaden the narrative of domestic violence exists, and we know that we can prevent domestic violence. We understand that it's preventable and that folks don't have to exist in relationships that are unhealthy. And one of the ways that we wanted to do that was to figure out how do we communicate prevention and that prevention is possible and what prevention is to the general public. And so what we were able to do is to get some funding to test out some messaging with folks in Pennsylvania and see what resonates with them and what makes sense with them. And what's actually funny that we learned is that we still do have some awareness raising to do around domestic violence, that not everyone is aware of what domestic violence is. And then from that, not everyone feels that we can prevent domestic violence, or that living in a world where violence in relationships doesn't exist doesn't feel tangible for folks.
Why not?
You know, that's a really good question. I think some of it is folks don't have the language to label domestic violence as domestic violence. I think it goes back to that sort of education piece a lot. And I think we don't often talk about it in a detailed way. We talk about domestic violence and how it's bad, but we don't get into specifics. And then even more than that, we don't talk about, well, what would a community look like if there wasn't domestic violence? We don't allow ourselves to sort of envision in that way.
So, you know, one of the things that strikes me, and I hope this isn't the case, but when you say that there are people who don't think that we can tangibly, you know, prevent it, that on the other hand, it almost seems like it's accepted. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah, and I don't believe that that's the case. I don't believe that there are a majority of folks in our communities that think that it's okay. I think it's a misunderstanding of what's okay and what's not okay, of what's acceptable in a relationship.
Are you still there?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay,
just
yeah.
My train of thought for a second.
Oh, I thought maybe your Zoom left us there, Kristen. Because that is an issue during this that's another issue during this pandemic that we have had. But what I was getting at is that I don't think that there, you know, you ask 100% of the people, 99.9% would say that domestic violence is not acceptable. But I guess what the thought that crossed my mind is that it is not a priority, or this is the way things have always been. If they think that we can't come up with a solution. But, you know, I'm also curious when you say that talk about the prevention messages that have resonated with people, and you're testing this. So I don't know whether you have enough information to say for sure, but what has resonated with people that you've found?
Yes. So we have been able to do some message testing, and what we're finding that resonates with folks are messages that feel relatable to them, that feel tangible, that feel unique. And just like you just shared, Scott, that prioritize domestic violence because we share about it, but we want to make sure that folks know that it's not okay and we are prioritizing it. And here's why. So some examples of what has worked with folks in terms of messaging are talking about the fact that domestic violence is underreported and misunderstood. So opening up that conversation of what is domestic violence? What does it look like in my life? And then some other messaging related to prevention that seems to have gone well is connecting it to some risk factors in communities that we know lead to or put folks at risk of experiencing domestic violence. For example, if we talk about poverty or having a lack of opportunity or access to resources. So what we're learning is the more specific that we can be with folks in having the conversation about what domestic violence is, but also what prevention could look like, That seems to resonate best.
If you have a question or comment about our discussion on domestic violence and the messaging that works, awareness, all those questions, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Kristen, something you just mentioned I wanted to talk more about, and that was risk factors. We know that... We've learned in many, many instances that poverty and not having, not having resources available to people, it makes it difficult in all walks of life or many walks of life. But domestic violence occurs across all socioeconomic levels. I mean, it is not just a problem of poor people, poor women, for example. I mean, there are people who have a lot of resources available to them who are the victims or the perpetrators of domestic violence. True?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and the risk factors are things that we've seen in research when we look at folks who are victims or survivors of domestic violence that have put them more at risk of experiencing violence in a relationship. So it's not that domestic violence is a poverty problem. That's certainly not the case. Just like you shared, it could happen to someone of any class status. It's that if folks experience more oppressions and more risks and have less access to resources and opportunities, it is more likely then that they will experience domestic violence.
How many people, you know, when we go back to statistics, I don't know if you have anything for 2020, but I know that your organization keeps track of the number of people who have died as the result of domestic violence. What are the latest statistics that you have for that?
Those I would have to look up specifically, but annually in Pennsylvania were over 100 deaths as a result of domestic violence. And we include both victims and perpetrators in our count because we don't want anyone to die from domestic violence. So we count everyone in that report, and I believe last year we were also over 100.
Yeah, I seem to remember in 2019, even over 120 that were killed. And I always hesitate to ask for statistics and numbers because, 120 deaths, but each one of those people, that was a person. And those were at least 120 families that were impacted by that. And 120 tragedies for each one of those. And those are just the deaths. That doesn't count the number of people who have been involved in relationships where there are domestic violence. And, you know, when you were talking about the definition, one of the things I wanted to bring up is that, you know, there this is not just a couples issue. We think of it mostly as that it is man and woman, or something that's happening more often today, same-sex couples, or at least that we're hearing more about it today, same-sex couples. But we're also talking about families, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Domestic violence can occur in relationships, in intimate partner relationships, and can also occur in familial relationships with parents and children.
We have an email here from Andrea. It says 99% of people may say domestic violence is bad, but because people who abuse often appear charming to their coworkers and family while creating hell at home, each person needs to examine if they will always support and believe victims. Their first thought may be, no way would that person do that, but they need to understand that if they stand by that person, they're adding to the pain that victims experience. This is especially the case in places like a church family. Your response to that, Kristen, that, you know, that I think that the point that she's making is a real good one, in that many times we find it hard to believe that someone who is so charming on, you know, that we meet one-on-one, that they actually could, you know, harm their partner or their spouse.
Yeah, absolutely. And that emailer brought up a couple good points, that it's very challenging with domestic violence because the other end of it is also a person who has family and lives in a community. And so it becomes very challenging for us to believe that this is possible. But that emailer is absolutely right, that it's important to believe victims and survivors when they share. And they also brought up being in a church community, which I think is a great opportunity, whether it's a community of faith or a different type of community or a neighborhood, that we're having these types of conversations and talking about what is domestic violence or what is a healthy relationship and what do we want that to look like in our communities. So I think they brought up a lot of great points and also a good place to start that conversation.
We only have about 2 minutes left, Kristen, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, one of our main points of conversation today is the prevention messages that the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence is trying to get out there. How do you do it during this pandemic when there is so much news, so much attention focused on the pandemic and other big news that we're hearing? How do you get your message out there?
I think that's a great question. Thank you. I think that we need to be consistent in our messaging, in messaging about domestic violence, making sure folks have access to those resources. And then I think figuring out how to connect what's going on with the pandemic, what's going on with folks' raised consciousness around racism and anti-racism, and make the connection for folks on how that relates to domestic violence, and sort of as a field, making sure that we are partnering with healthcare advocates and with anti-racism advocates so that the work that is being done now, if it's not prioritizing domestic violence specifically, it's prioritizing safe and healthy communities, and that will help prevent domestic violence.
We only have a minute or so left. For those who are listening who may be in a situation where they are the victim of domestic violence or there's domestic violence in the home, what can they do? What resources do they have?
So if someone's experiencing domestic violence, one of the best resources is the national hotline, and that is 1-800-799-7233, or you can visit them online at thehotline.org. And then if folks want their specific Pennsylvania local programs, they can go to our website, PCADV, which is an acronym for the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence.org.
Kristen Herman is the Director of Prevention for the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.